For decades, Israel and the United States have engaged Iran in a shadow war across the Middle East, using the whole region as their massive geopolitical chessboard in their attempts to outmaneuver each other. But throughout all this time, until very recently, both sides maintained a taboo against attacking each other's territory directly, choosing to strike each other indirectly from the shadows through proxies and espionage instead. Iran maintained attacks and pressure on Israel through their proxies like Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Houthis, while Israel carried out a campaign of covert sabotage within Iran using a dense network of informants and spies. This was the way the Cold War between both sides was fought for decades, until the long taboo on directly attacking each other's territory was suddenly broken in 2024. In April of that year, after Israel bombed the Iranian consulate in Syria's capital and killed several senior Iranian officials there, Iran retaliated by firing over 150 ballistic and cruise missiles directly at Israeli territory, marking the first time that Iran directly attacked Israeli territory itself. Almost all of the missiles were shot down, and then Israel retaliated by launching limited airstrikes directly on Iranian territory for the first time as well. Later in October of 2024, with the taboo already broken and following Israel's assassination of Hamas's political leader on Iranian soil, Iran attacked Israel's territory directly for a second, even larger time using around 200 missiles, causing only minor damage again. Both of these incidents of direct attacks between them were merely preludes for what was coming in June of 2025 last month, however, when Israel and Iran absolutely shattered the long-running taboo on attacking each other's territories directly. On the 12th of June, the UN's nuclear watchdog agency, the International Atomic Energy Agency, or the IAEA, declared for the first time that Iran was in breach of its nuclear non-proliferation commitments. The very next day, the Israelis launched a massive surprise attack directly against Iranian territory, involving overwhelming airstrikes along with commando and Mossad operatives who were hidden deep within Iran itself on the ground. Around 200 Israeli warplanes hammered almost 100 targets across Iranian territory just on the opening wave of the surprise attack alone, targeting the country's nuclear sites, missile launchers, air defenses, energy infrastructure, and senior commanders and leadership. Over the next 10 days, dozens of further Israeli airstrikes continued bombarding these same kinds of targets all across Iran with devastating results. At least 14 of Iran's leading nuclear scientists and experts were killed in the attacks, along with dozens of senior Iranian military and intelligence officials, including the chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces and the commander-in-chief of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, arguably the two most senior military commanders in the entire country, along with the head of the Iranian missile program for good measure, no doubt paralyzing the Iranian military's decision-making capabilities in the process. Scores of Iran's air defenses and outdated fighter aircraft were obliterated on the ground, and as much as two-thirds of Iran's ballistic missile launchers were wiped out during the campaign as well. Israel codenamed its surprise attack and ensuing operations against Iran as Operation Rising Lion, a clear reference to the pre-revolutionary symbol of Iran, the lion, suggesting that Israel's ultimate objective in the campaign went beyond just curbing Iran's nuclear weapons program and was intended to go even further and cause the toppling of the country's theocratic regime as well. Iran almost immediately began retaliating for Israel's attacks, and over the coming 12 days, Iran would fire a similarly unprecedented 532 ballistic and cruise missiles directly at Israeli territory. As in the past, the vast majority of them were either intercepted, misfired, or struck empty parts of the country. But 31 of these Iranian missiles also managed to directly strike major Israeli population centers, causing extensive damage to Israeli urban areas and killing 29 Israelis in the process, all of them civilians. Iran's missiles failed to strike any Israeli military targets like air bases that could have hurt the Israeli war effort, while Israeli strikes devastated Iran's military with significant civilian harm as well, killing as many as 935 people across the country, including many civilians, according to Iran. Iran failed to shoot down a single Israeli jet during the entire campaign, and only managed to down a couple of Israel's unmanned drones, showing how thoroughly Israel had managed to establish and maintain aerial supremacy over Iran during the entire conflict. Israel repeatedly bombarded many of Iran's most strategically important nuclear research sites throughout its days of attacks. But there were two facilities in particular where Israel's weaponry couldn't reach: Iran's two largest nuclear enrichment plants in Natanz and Fort Doe, both buried deep underneath mountainsides that shielded them from most forms of aerial attacks. Israel's leadership appealed to the United States to join directly in the war with their advanced 30,000-pound GBU-57 bunker buster bombs, the only conventional ordnance known in the world theoretically capable of striking the two buried Iranian nuclear enrichment sites since they are rated to be able to penetrate through 60 meters of solid concrete before detonating their massive payload. The Trump administration began flooding reinforcements of aircrafts, fleets, and soldiers to the Middle East theater. All the while, the negotiations with Iran over the country's nuclear program continued. But in the end, on the 22nd of June, the Trump administration decided to answer the Israeli call to war and joined with their own unprecedented direct attack on Iranian territory as well, with the goal of crushing the country's nuclear ambitions once and for all. Dubbed Operation Midnight Hammer, the American surprise attack on Iran's nuclear research sites was one of the most complex and technical operations ever carried out in the U.S. military's entire history. America's B-2 stealth bomber fleet, which are capable of carrying the GBU-57 bunker busters, are all primarily stationed at Whiteman Air Force Base in the U.S. state of Missouri. In order to carefully maintain the element of surprise, two groups of B-2 bombers sorted out from Whiteman on the 21st of June, the day before the actual attack, and traveled west across the Pacific in order to serve as a decoy for anyone who might have been watching or paying attention. The next day, on the 22nd, the main strike package, consisting of seven B-2 bombers loaded up with the bunker busters, departed from Whiteman and traveled east, maintaining almost zero communications and complete radio silence for an 18-hour non-stop flight toward Iran, undergoing multiple aerial refuelings across the Atlantic and Mediterranean so that they would never have to stop. By the time they approached Iranian airspace, they were joined by many dozens of fighter escorts, just as an American nuclear submarine operating somewhere nearby fired more than two dozen Tomahawk cruise missiles aimed towards Iran's nuclear research site at Isfahan. As those missiles were still airborne, the B-2s and their fighter escorts entered into Iranian airspace from the west, and moments later, they dropped a total of 12 of their heavy bunker busters on Iran's Fordo enrichment site, and another two of their bunker busters on the Natanz enrichment site, just at about the same time as the submarine-fired Tomahawk missiles began impacting at the Isfahan site. All of the American aircraft that participated in the raid, around 125 of them in total, were able to safely remove themselves from Iranian airspace after the attack without suffering a single casualty. And only a couple of days later, the Trump administration was able to force a ceasefire between Iran and Israel, ending the past 12 days of relentless fighting and bombardments between them. No doubt, somewhat disappointing the Israeli government that was likely hoping for even heavier American attacks that would have toppled the entire Iranian government. And ever since, there has been an enormous amount of debate and controversy over how much damage the American attacks actually did to the Iranian nuclear weapons program, and by extension, how quickly the Iranians might be able to reconstitute their program. Iran's nuclear program was well distributed across several different sites around the country in order to make it harder for enemies to disrupt and attack it. And Iran is a huge country, coming in at about the same size as the entire southwestern corner of the U.S. mainland. Assembling a nuclear weapon is an extremely complex process and requires multiple different steps, each of which have been affected differently by the 12 days of Israeli and American airstrikes. The first step is simply mining the raw uranium ore that's required for a bomb. There are two active uranium mines within Iran, with the largest being the Sanghand mine in the central east of Iran. However, harvesting raw uranium from mines is usually the incorrect type to build a nuclear weapon with. 99% of the uranium out there in nature is known as U-238, 238 referring to the mass of each atom. In order to build a bomb, a lighter form of uranium called U-235 is required instead. But only 0.7% of the uranium in nature is actually U-235. Iran's uranium mines were not targeted by either the Israeli or American attacks this past month, so Iran's ability to continue mining raw uranium has not been impacted. But in order to produce the lighter uranium that's required for a bomb, its metal form needs to be converted into a gas so that it can be purified, a form called uranium hexafluoride. There is only one facility known in Iran that was capable of converting natural metal uranium into this gaseous state, and it was in Isfahan, which was repeatedly bombed by Israeli jets and further attacked by the American submarine-fired Tomahawk cruise missiles. Satellite images taken of the Isfahan complex after the attacks show multiple buildings and laboratories above ground there that are severely damaged, which has most likely crippled Iran's capability to convert uranium into gas for now, establishing the first of several major bottlenecks that now exist in the country's nuclear weapons program that will probably take years to repair. After the metal has been converted into gas, the next and most challenging step in the weapon-building process is to enrich the gas, which is done so by putting the gas into enormous arrays of advanced high-speed centrifuges that rapidly spin the uranium hexafluoride gas. During this step, the heavier U-238 generally moves to the outside of the centrifuge, making the gas in the center of the centrifuge steadily richer in the lighter U-235. Once this process is repeated in the centrifuges multiple times over, the concentration of U-235 in the gas can be raised up to as high as 90%, which is the purity threshold considered to be weapons-grade uranium. The two largest known enrichment sites that Iran possessed were Natanz and Fort Doe, both of them built deep underground beneath two different mountains with vast holes of centrifuges beneath them, each containing more than 18,000 centrifuges apiece, with Fort Doe containing the more modern and advanced series of centrifuges. The fate of what exactly ended up happening at these sites during the attacks is some of the most contentious and debated at the moment. Israeli airstrikes targeted and likely destroyed most, if not all, of the centrifuges and Natanz after they eliminated the site's electrical power supply, while the U.S. dropped two of their heavy bunker buster bombs on the site to destroy the underground infrastructure just for good measure, while further Israeli airstrikes targeted known Iranian manufacturing plants that built additional centrifuges. The U.S. B-2 bombers also dropped 12 more of the bunker busters on the Fort Doe site, which was the primary target of the Americans. Satellite images of the site taken afterward show two sets of three impact craters where the bunker busters impacted. There were only six impact craters because each of the locations was precisely hit by two of the bunker busters, one after the other, in order to fully penetrate all the way down to the about 90-meter depth that the Fort Doe enrichment site was believed to be located. The bunker busters were likely targeting the Fort Doe site's sole ventilation shaft and associated access tunnels, while the shock waves sent from the bombs likely radiated all throughout the mountain and damaged the centrifuges within it, which are very sensitive to external vibrations while they're in use, and they're exceptionally difficult to turn off without causing any unwanted damage. Donald Trump himself has repeatedly claimed that the Fort Doe site was completely obliterated by the attack, while the IAEA has also said that the centrifuges at Fort Doe have appeared to be no longer in operation. But there has been a degree of uncertainty as to exactly how much damage the bunker busters caused to the Fort Doe enrichment site. The day after the attack, a preliminary classified damage assessment report was leaked from the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Pentagon's military intelligence agency, which concluded that the strikes had only set Iran's nuclear program back by just a few months, rather than by a few years. It concluded that many of Iran's enrichment centrifuges had in fact remained intact, and that the country likely retained other secret enrichment facilities that still remained operational. The report further concluded that while the bunker busters likely damaged Fort Doe's electrical systems and collapsed its entrance tunnels, the main underground enrichment hull likely continued to remain intact. But there's also good reason to doubt the DIA's initial assessment of the situation. The analysts themselves who prepared the report labeled it as low confidence, while its sources were based entirely on satellite imagery and intercepted communications, which are not necessarily the most reliable. David Albright, a former IAEA inspector, has suggested that further evidence that arrived after the DIA's report indicated that Iran likely lost around 20,000 of their centrifuges in the Fort Doe and Natanz bombings, severely handicapping their ability to further enrich their surviving uranium supplies to weapons grade. Other American intelligence agencies and officials like the CIA and the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, have also stressed that the damage inflicted on Fort Doe and other sites by the attacks have indeed set the Iranian nuclear program back by years rather than months, while Israeli agencies like their Atomic Energy Commission have also claimed the same thing as well. So Iran's ability to enrich uranium has almost certainly been degraded, but the true extent of that damage right now remains unclear. There's also an even bigger problem, because even if the U.S. attacks truly did obliterate the enrichment sites in Natanz and Fort Doe as they claim, it might not have been enough to have stopped their development of a bomb. Merely a week before the Israelis began carrying out their airstrikes across Iran, IAEA inspectors operating in the country estimated that the Iranians had around 400 kilograms, or about 900 pounds, worth of highly enriched uranium that was already concentrated to 60% purity, just within range of the 90% purity required for a bomb. James Acton, the co-director of the Nuclear Policy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, has since written that it would only take a single cascade of 174 centrifuges, a total time of between 10 and 20 days, to further enrich that supply of 60% enriched uranium into 90% enriched weapons-grade fuel. Had Iran ever taken the decision to have done that, that fuel would have been enough to have powered between 9 and 10 atomic bombs. Iran basically chose to pursue a strategy of enriching their uranium supply to just beneath the weapons-grade threshold in order to A, maintain a form of plausible deniability about what they were really doing, and B, give themselves the option of rapidly sprinting towards a bomb if they felt the situation was dire enough at any given time. However, as recently as just a few months before the Israeli and American attacks in March of 2025, Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence in the United States, testified in front of Congress that Iran had not yet taken the decision to enrich their uranium supply any further, and there were no signs at all that the Iranians were actively preparing to advance their nuclear program any further down the supply chain. Nonetheless, this supply of 400 kilograms worth of 60% enriched uranium is the single most valuable asset that the Iranian regime currently possesses. And extremely troublingly right now, nobody outside of the Iranian regime has any idea of where it actually is. The preliminary DIA assessment issued the day after the American bombing suggests that the Iranians likely moved that material to an unknown secret location early on in the conflict. Satellite images taken over the Fordo enrichment facility in the days leading up to the American attack show more than a dozen cargo trucks stationed outside of the facility's entrance, suggesting that Iran may have been moving the enriched uranium in some of the centrifuges from the site before it was actually attacked, which has been repeatedly denied by the Trump administration since. Other trucks were spotted by satellites at the Isfahan complex leading up to the American attack as well, where the Iranians were known to be storing a lot of that enriched uranium at. The IAEA had said just a week before the start of the Israeli airstrikes that the Iranians were storing a lot of the enriched uranium there in specialized casks that were small enough to fit in the trunks of only about 10 cars, implying that they could have easily been relocated to unknown locations from there and safeguarded. Ultimately, the UN's IAEA, America's DIA, and multiple European intelligence agencies currently believe that Iran relocated most, if not all, of its enriched uranium supplies before the attacks happened, while the Trump administration has insisted that it was all or mostly destroyed, but has so far not offered up any convincing evidence of that. If Iran ended up shielding enough of their centrifuges from the attacks in other discrete locations and maintained additional smaller covert enrichment facilities, it'd be theoretically possible for the regime to decide on sprinting towards a bomb and further enriching their surviving supply towards the 90% weapons-grade fuel they could potentially use to power between 9 and 10 atomic bombs. But even if they were able to do that, Iran might still face another critical bottleneck in the next step of the weapons-building process anyway, which is actually converting the 90% weapons-grade enriched uranium gas back into its metal form again, a process known as metallization that is required to build a bomb's explosive core. Iran's sole known active metallization facility was at the sprawling Isfahan complex above ground that was relentlessly bombarded by Israeli airstrikes and the American Tomahawk missiles, which likely destroyed it enough that it'll take the Iranians years to rebuild it. Without this crucial capability, Iran will not be able to build a bomb even if it manages to rapidly enrich its surviving supplies of uranium gas to weapons grade. Although it has been pointed out that Iran has maintained other known metallization plants in the past that could potentially be restarted again, and it might have other secret metallization plants elsewhere where the work could be conducted away from prying eyes, though there is no publicly known intelligence that currently suggests that. Similarly and finally, even if Iran finishes the metallization process, it would still have to miniaturize further crucial components, like a detonator system, in order to properly fit it on a delivery system like a warhead on a missile. Iran may or may not have this capability right now. It's a little unclear and depends on what source you're looking at. But the Israelis did bomb and destroy multiple buildings at Iran's Sanjerian manufacturing plant, which was known to produce these kinds of miniaturized detonator systems, which also might complicate Iran's ability to finish this final step of a bomb's construction as well. Although, like its potentially secret hidden metallization and enrichment facilities, Iran could maintain other hidden detonator system plants as well. Basically, nobody really knows at this point the true extent of the damage that the Israeli and American attacks did to Iran's nuclear program. Several key elements of the supply chain required to build a bomb have no doubt been damaged, including Iran's ability to convert uranium metal into gas, their ability to further enrich the uranium gas, and their ability to reconvert the enriched gas back into metal again, to say nothing of their 14 senior nuclear scientists who were killed, creating at least three probable bottlenecks in their production process that will take an unknown amount of time for them to recover from. But Iran also probably still retains most of their 400 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium gas. And if they can manage to covertly reconstitute their centrifuge and metallization processes, they could likely manage to sprint towards an arsenal of 9 or 10 bombs within weeks of doing so. The unanswered questions on everybody's mind right now are thus, How much of Iran's supply of 60% enriched uranium gas actually survived, and where is it currently located? And how quickly can Iran reconstitute their enrichment and metallization processes? These questions are now at the center of the negotiations between the U.S. and Iran over a renewed nuclear deal. But there are substantial obstacles standing in the way of negotiations being successful now. Trump continues to insist that Iran agree to completely scuttle its entire enrichment processes permanently, or there won't be any deal at all. Something that the Iranians are almost certainly never going to agree to now, because they no doubt view their eventual acquisition of a nuclear bomb as their only guarantee of safety in this dangerous world. Over the past nearly 2 years of war across the Middle East, Iran has completely lost its carefully built-up conventional deterrence to relentless Israeli and American attacks. Its proxies at Hezbollah and Hamas had spent tens of billions of dollars in decades building up have been completely crippled. Its allied regime in Syria has been toppled. While Israeli and American warplanes showed that they were capable of bombarding the country and killing its senior leadership with complete impunity, Iran's only possible way to maintain deterrent standing is completing its nuclear project. And they have zero trust in the Trump administration or Israel that if they give that up, they won't just take advantage of it and try and topple their even more exposed regime later. Remember that prior negotiations over Iran's long-running nuclear program during the Obama era eventually culminated in 2015 with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, sometimes also called the Iran nuclear deal, which accomplished several notable things at the time. Iran then agreed that it would eliminate its enrichment program and would shut down their huge Fordow enrichment site for 15 years until 2030. And they would also submit themselves to extremely intrusive weapons inspections from the IAEA to routinely verify that they remained in compliance. In exchange, multiple US, EU, and UN sanctions that had been previously imposed on Iran would be lifted, including on their oil exports and $100 billion worth of frozen overseas assets that were unfrozen, granting the moribund Iranian economy a much-needed and welcome boost. Any of those sanctions could also be immediately reimposed unilaterally through a snapback mechanism if Iran was ever to be found in non-compliance. Even if Iran pulled out of the deal, the JCPOA had restricted Iran's nuclear capabilities by such an extent, it was seen that it would be impossible for them to have developed a weapon within a year of pulling out, giving the world enough time to resort to military action if that ever happened. Nonetheless, there were several opponents to the deal in the West and a lot of substantial criticism. Some critics of the JCPOA blasted it as only a band-aid to the problem, only restricting Iran's nuclear program for 15 years and only delaying it until 2030 rather than decisively shutting it down for good. Israel and Netanyahu's government fiercely objected to the deal, claiming that it legitimized the Iranian nuclear program and claiming that Iran would either find ways to violate the agreement or would simply wait it out for 15 years and just restart it again later, kicking the Iranian nuclear can down the road for future leaders to figure out instead. The deal also didn't address or put any limits on Iran's ballistic missile program, and it freed up huge amounts of cash for Iran to begin piling into its various regional proxy forces like Hezbollah, the Houthis, and Hamas, which further inflamed tensions between Iran and the Gulf Arab states and led to countries like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates opposing the deal as well. While intended to last for 15 years, the JCPOA only ended up lasting for 3 years until 2018, when the Trump administration unilaterally pulled the U.S. out of the deal and reimposed crushing sanctions on Iran instead, despite the fact that all evidence at the time indicated that the Iranians were upholding their end of the deal. Back then, Obama predicted that Trump's decision to do this was going to eventually present America with what he called the losing choice between a nuclear-armed Iran or another war in the Middle East. Enraged and feeling betrayed by the collapse of the deal, the pragmatists and the Iranian regime who had been steadily gaining momentum were sidelined in favor of the hardliners again. And with the crushing American sanctions reimposed, Iran quickly began restarting small elements of their nuclear program and gradually violating the original terms of the JCPOA. Small-scale enrichment began again, centrifuge production and use increased, and access to the IAEA was steadily restricted again. Then in January of 2020, after Trump ordered the drone strike that killed one of Iran's most senior generals who was in Iraq at the time, Qasem Soleimani, Iran declared that they were no longer going to abide by any of the remaining limits on their nuclear enrichment program. And so their stockpile of enriched uranium began rapidly expanding again from almost nothing to include the increasing volumes of highly enriched uranium at 60% within only a stone's throw away of the 90% weapons-grade fuel. After Joe Biden became America's next president in 2021, he promised to renegotiate another nuclear deal with Iran, but for years, it proved to be too difficult, with a lack of trust since Trump ripped the U.S. out of the last deal. Throughout his term in office, Biden insisted that Iran needed to return back to the original restrictions on their program imposed by the JCPOA before he would lift the reimposed sanctions. While the Iranians continued to insist the opposite and demanded that the sanctions be lifted first as a sign of trust. No side ever proved willing or capable of budging for years. And then came the Hamas attack on Israel in October of 2023, which sparked the series of events into motion that led to Hamas and Hezbollah getting catastrophically crippled and the Assad regime in Syria collapsing, completely undermining Iran's strategy of conventional deterrence and exposing them for the first time in decades to direct Israeli and American attacks. As Iran's nuclear enrichment continued, the second Trump administration demanded that any new nuclear deal would require them to stop enriching completely, which Iran continued refusing to do, which set the stage for war. Now Iran is faced with two major sets of precedents to consider with any further negotiations on their program. The first are the many recent historical precedents that have happened to other countries who gave up their nuclear weapons programs and were subsequently invaded or attacked by outside powers who didn't fear them any longer. The Gaddafi regime in Libya agreed to give up their nuclear weapons program in 2003, and then only 8 years later, NATO led a military intervention into the country that toppled his regime and led directly to his death. In 1994, Ukraine agreed to surrender their inherited arsenal of Soviet-era nuclear weapons to Russia in exchange for security guarantees that their territorial integrity would be permanently respected. And then 20 years later, Russia invaded Ukraine and seized Crimea, and then launched a full-scale invasion into the country that's still ongoing. And most infamously of all for this precedent is the case of Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which pursued a nuclear weapons program throughout the 1980s that was decisively shut down after the 1991 Gulf War, and then painstakingly contained by the United States through a combination of no-fly zones, sanctions, espionage, and occasional bombings for another decade that all proved to be a long prelude to the 2003 invasion of the country, which collapsed Saddam's regime and led to his death. Iran fears that it is now the next Iraq or Libya. They fear that with our conventional deterrence crippled with Hamas and Hezbollah down on their knees and their ballistic missiles and launchers largely destroyed, if they give up their nuclear program now, even after the damage it has sustained through the Israeli and American attacks, the U.S. will sooner or later simply treat them the same way they did Libya and Iraq beforehand and attempt to topple their regime without a fear of major deterrence. This lack of trust is not reinforced by the enormous presence of the U.S. military around them in the Middle East right now, and the shattering of the taboo on direct attacks on Iranian soil now. There is also, of course, the North Korean precedent, another regime who the West has been extremely hostile to. But since their successful development of their own nuclear weapons program back in 2006, North Korea has never faced so much as a single attack from the outside world because they possess the ultimate deterrent. North Korea's strategy of withdrawing from the NPT in 2003 after the Iraq precedent and immediately sprinting towards the bomb that they acquired 3 years later has proven infinitely more successful than Iran's more reserved strategy of slowly keeping themselves just beneath the nuclear threshold in a failed attempt to prevent an outside attack. The lessons that have been continually reinforced since the turn of the century is that acquiring the bomb is the only way to guarantee regime survivability and territorial integrity in the world today. And this is why any negotiations, even with all of the damage that's already been inflicted on Iran's nuclear program, will be exceedingly difficult to navigate through. And then there's the precedent already set by the United States of agreeing to a deal with Iran on the program in 2015, only to then renege on the deal and unilaterally withdraw from it just 3 years later. From Iran's perspective, who's to say that won't just happen again? I think that the most likely outcome here is that so long as the hardline revolutionary regime remains in power in Iran, the regime will continue seeing the bomb as its only guarantee of survival, like the Kims in North Korea have. Israel and the Gulf Arab states will also continue seeing Iran's nuclear program as an unacceptable existential threat to their own survivals, and they will continue trying to rope in the United States to try and help them contain it, potentially leading to a similar situation going forward as the U.S. faced with Saddam's Iraq throughout the 1990s, where the U.S. just keeps on having to deploy occasional force to continually delay and suppress the program whenever they feel it's getting too close to becoming successful, tying up critical American military resources in the Middle East while it's attempting to maintain its focus on China and Taiwan, and locking the US in a yet another version of an unpopular forever war back in the sandbox. Is this outcome actually better than what we already had under the JCPOA before 2018? Which probably would have continued delaying all of this from happening until at least 2030, and it would have enabled America to maintain more of its focus on China for longer. Either way you lean on that, at this point, I think it's only a matter of time until the next nuclear crisis with Iran erupts. So long as Iran sees the acquisition of a bomb as being vital for their own security, and Israel and the Gulf Arabs view it as an unacceptable threat to their own security. In order to understand the modern Middle East, you need to understand how the many wars and conflicts over the past few years here have set the current conflict into motion and prepared the board for both Iran and Israel's moves. The long history of Israel's military occupation of the Palestinian territories like the West Bank and Gaza paved the way for the rise of Hamas and Israel's siege of Gaza, followed by Hamas's October 7th attack and Israel's subsequent invasion and arguable genocide there. The civil war that tore Lebanon apart in the 1980s and Israel's military intervention into it directly led to the birth of Hezbollah and the conflict on Israel's northern flank. The long and complicated civil war in Syria that lasted for longer than a decade paved the way for the Assad regime's collapse that enabled Israeli warplanes to consider a direct attack on Iran for the first time in 2025. The similarly long and complicated civil war in Yemen that saw a massive Saudi Arabian-led military intervention paved the way for the Iranian-aligned Houthis to establish their control over most of the country's major population centers. While the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and the preceding Saddam Hussein regime's invasions of Kuwait and Iran led directly to the weakening of Iraq's institutions and the infiltration of Iraqi society by the Iranian regime. All of these conflicts across the Middle East are deeply interconnected, and they're all part of the foundation of knowledge for understanding how we got to where we are today. And as with every major conflict that I've covered before on this channel, there's always far more complexity than can ever be fully explored in just a single YouTube video, especially when the topics are as sensitive and controversial as covert nuclear programs, foreign armed interventions, and regional warfare. And this is exactly why I created my Modern Conflict series, which includes standalone, in-depth documentaries into all of these preceding Middle Eastern conflicts like the Israel-Hamas conflict, the October 7th attack, and the Lebanon-Syria and Yemen civil wars that will all give you the invaluable prior context that you need to understand what's really happening here today. Over the past 4 years, I've created around 50 total episodes in Modern Conflicts covering the most major wars, operations, and conflicts of the 21st century, also including multiple episodes into the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war, the civil wars in Sudan and Myanmar, the 2012 Benghazi embassy siege, the Armenia-Azerbaijan wars, and dozens of other episodes, with new ones coming out all the time, exclusively on Nebula. Because of the inherently violent and controversial details surrounding the discussion of all of this, these Modern Conflict documentaries would all become demonetized and age-restricted if they were on YouTube, which means that YouTube's algorithm, which is based around showing you ads, would never be incentivized to actually show the videos to you or to promote them. I deal with very large numbers of my more mild videos on YouTube getting demonetized and age-restricted as they are, and that's why I upload all of my episodes in Modern Conflicts exclusively to Nebula, and why signing up to Nebula is the absolute best thing that you can do to support me and my channel. And you'll also get access to way more content than just my exclusive Modern Conflict series there as well. Because the best part about Nebula is that it's jointly co-owned by myself and hundreds of other independent creators to make the projects that we're all actually deeply excited about, without any fear of being censored or demonetized like we are on YouTube. And that's why there's tons of other new unique content on Nebula that's coming out all the time too that you'll also love. Like Bobby Broccoli's incredible new feature-length documentary called 17 Pages, Lindsay Ellis's now exclusive to Nebula documentaries, and the Wendover Productions team's hilarious Abolish Everything series, and so many others. I also know that there's a lot of streaming platforms out there right now and you don't really want to get stuck with another monthly cost to keep track of. But I also know that if you watched this all the way through to the end, there is so much content on Nebula that you'll love as well, and so much more coming out with every new month that you could consider a lifetime membership to Nebula for as long as we both last, and then you'll never have to worry about a recurring subscription or ads ever again. That's the best way possible to support what I'm doing here on Real Life Lore. But even if you'd rather not make that large of an upfront commitment, you can still help support me by signing up for a yearly or a monthly subscription to Nebula as well, which you can get for a fantastic deal with 40% off by scanning the QR code or clicking the button here on your screen right now, or by following the link that's down below in the description. Any of which will also get you access to everything on Nebula for the very low price of just $3 per month or $36 a year. I hope that you'll consider signing up. And as always, thank you so much for watching.